Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now, according to the CDC, more than 4,300 cases of monkeypox have been identified in 48 countries around the world, and nearly 250 of those cases are in the United States. The most recent outbreaks have been concentrated primarily among gay and bisexual men who have sex with men. Monkeypox, which is in the same family as smallpox, has symptoms ranging from blistering rashes, exhaustion, body aches, chills, and fever. While the CDC announced that the threat in the U.S. is low, some experts say officials are not responding with an appropriate level of urgency. New York City recently made monkeypox vaccines available to men who have sex with men, but the city has not had enough supply to meet demand among those seeking to get vaccinated. I'm joined now by Greg Gonsalves, who's Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Greg.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with monkeypox. How dangerous is it, both for an individual who might contract it, but also from a kind of a broader community perspective?
So a couple of things. This is an endemic disease in West and Central Africa, so it's been around for a while, right? There are two general strains of it, one most frequently in West Africa and another one that appears most commonly in Central Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The West African strain seems to be less virulent, at least in terms of clinical outcomes, than the variant from Central Africa. And there have really been no deaths. Maybe there's been one death across this current outbreak, except it's now sort of digging its heels in into the gay, lesbian, transgender community in the United States and around the world in 44 countries, and could persist over time, making it a hazard for these individuals, but also risking a jump into other kinds of settings in which there's close physical contact, which is the way this disease is transmitted.
Okay. We have some history and experience worldwide and particularly in the U.S. when an endemic disease that's contagious becomes concentrated in what we might describe as a marginalized population, right? Whether that is among people with low socioeconomic status, among queer communities, among Black or brown folks. So often when that happens, historically, we've had underreporting of cases. So what are your thoughts right now about how accurately we're capturing the current spread?
Oh, we are clearly not capturing the current spread. As you suggested, this is happening in marginalized populations among men who have sex with men. It's also happening in the context of these very tight social and sexual networks in which people are having multiple partners, often anonymous partners. And these are very private sort of acts and situations, and people may not want to come forward to name exposure. As I said, again, while the lesions are painful and you get a flu-like illness accompanying it, it's not likely to kill you. So many people may just suffer through whatever they have and not come forward. So people are suggesting, you know, we're way underreporting in the United States. We also have testing, which is running through the laboratory resource networks from the CDC, which has been criticized by a variety of people, including Jay Varma, formerly of the New York City Health Department, and Jennifer Nuzzo, I think who's at Brown now, suggesting we need to move this into like commercial labs so doctors can do this as easily as they do a swab for something else in their office. So we're desperately underdiagnosing it. Remember, gay pride events are happening, LGBT pride events are happening across the nation, well, and across the world. And so the chance for amplification of this outbreak is real. And you know, what we see right now is just the tip of the iceberg.
Greg, I do want to go back and dig in again on this question of marginalized populations and your point that we're in Pride Month still. So we're talking about big, you know, parties and celebrations and marches and public demonstrations. But I do also want to be clear, this is not a disease based on identity, right? I mean, once we're talking about close contact, then presumably, even if most of the cases are concentrated among men who have sex with men right now, that would change fairly rapidly. Is that right? I don't want to cause alarm. I just want to be clear here.
Yeah, no, this is not about who you are. It's about what you do. And it's about repeated close contact. You know, the reason we're seeing it in these sort of subpopulations of the LGBT community is because, you know, early cases were tied to raves in Europe, in which, you know, people are packed together dancing on dance floors and anonymous sex venues. You know, so if you think of a potential for it to jump into other populations, you think about where people will be in close physical contact, homeless shelters, in prisons and jails. In terms of like a general population spread, it's hard for me to think of it being a problem. The one other piece of this, which is upsetting to me, frankly, is that New York City announced vaccines for gay men or sex with men last week, and there was a rush on them, right? But the setup was in Chelsea. It was in the middle of the day, and that's not setting us up for an equitable response to this outbreak. In the end, it's going to linger in the people who have least access to healthcare resources, least contact with public health in the United States, and we know what that means.
So the kind of Chelsea setup in the middle of the day is indicative of a whiter population or a less racially diverse population, a wealthier population, right? And folks who presumably can take time off in the middle of the day.
In terms of clinical danger from monkeypox, if you are HIV positive and don't know your status, or you're HIV positive and you're not doing well on antiretroviral therapy, you may be in more danger of clinical complications from the infection. And we know where in New York City there are more people undiagnosed with HIV and where viral load is unsuppressed from HIV across the city. And it's not necessarily in Chelsea. And so we need to make sure that as we roll out these vaccines for monkeypox, as we ramp up testing, that we do it in an equitable way, not just in New York City, of course, across mm-hmm. the country.
I'm just wondering in part if there is an attempt not to create the kind of stigmas we know can be associated, or if not giving that kind of information actually ends up being an epidemiological problem. In other words, in this case, is more information better or maybe less information?
Well, I think we're walking a fine line. Many of the federal health officials that we're dealing with in this outbreak are old hands at HIV. So they know the dangers of stigmatizing populations and stigmatizing diseases. So there's been a really concerted effort to say that this is not a gay disease, to refrain from any sort of stigmatization of behaviors or people. That being said, the outbreak right now is among men who have sex with men, and we need to get the information out through those communities and social networks. And LGBT Q health organizations, HIV AIDS organizations are perfectly primed to do this. So we have to walk the fine line. No stigma, please, but information and education and outreach, yes.
Do we know anything about issues of misdiagnosis?
Well, you know, the thing is, most clinicians, most people have not seen monkeypox in the United States. So it's really something new for clinicians and for the community in which it's happening. You know, there is some suspicion that this disease outbreak might be presenting differently than it has in previous instances of its appearance. And so lesions could be confined to sort of the genital area and appear like herpes or syphilis lesions. So there's a question of whether, as you said, there might be misdiagnosis because somebody thinks it's an STI or sexually transmitted disease or something else. So it's been important to get pictures out there so that clinicians and people can understand what these lesions look like and be aware that they need to seek medical help should they see that one of these on their body at any place, whether it's the genital area or their trunk, their arms, their neck, their face.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back because there is also still a pandemic happening in this country and it's called COVID. This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm back now with Greg Gonsalves, who is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Greg and I have been talking about the rise in monkeypox cases around the world and here in the U.S., but since we've got Greg, I wanted to be sure that we turn now to some of the recent developments related to COVID-19. The CDC has approved vaccines for children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years old. Some parents are feeling even more confident about reentering the world now that their littlest ones can be vaccinated. But there's also still considerable vaccine hesitancy among parents of those under five. In addition, the CDC has also rescinded its COVID-19 testing orders for incoming travelers. So let's just talk about where we are in the pandemic right now, Greg. I will say I'm currently in a household full of COVID positive people. I'm not allowing any of my family members to come downstairs. I keep saying, text me if you want food. But look, it's, you know, we're almost, I guess we're more than 2 years in. Everyone is vaccinated and boosted in the household. And these have been the first cases in my immediate family. But it really is a reminder that we're still in a pandemic.
We're still in a pandemic, and frankly, there's more replication of the virus going on now than there's been in quite a while. We have a very contagious strain. We have sort of almost a complete unilateral disarmament in terms of any sort of protection mechanisms. And so, you know, while we're not seeing deaths explode like we did previous winter and early spring, it's a huge disruption in people's lives. You know, for everybody who's upstairs in your household, that's happening across the country, and people are having to postpone work and personal events. Flights are being interrupted. Medical procedures are being interrupted. Schooling is being interrupted. And so, like, while we may think the pandemic is quote unquote over and we're vaxxed and done, anybody who's lived over the past few months and has had a family member or a friend get infected with COVID realizes, you know, they're out of commission for a few days or a couple of weeks, right? So the pandemic is still a big part of the American experience, even though we're pretending that it's all in the rearview mirror.
So when I hear you say that it's replicating more swiftly, what do you mean there?
If you go to the CDC webpage, they have a map that says, that talks about community levels, and that looks sort of green and happy. But that's based on hospitalizations and deaths, which are not at the peaks they were. But if you click down on their menu and look for community transmission, the map turns red. It means that there's very, very many cases being transmitted across the country from coast to coast, north to south, east to west. And so lots of people, as you describe, are getting infected with COVID. And they may not end up in the hospital, but those who are at severe risk of clinical complications, those who are immunocompromised, those who are under-vaccinated or not vaccinated at all or not boosted, you know, at risk of more serious complications. And then there's the disruption and dysfunction that it's causing in our economy and in our personal and our professional lives. So we have lots of SARS-CoV-2 spreading around the country, and people don't think it matters. And then there's always the question of long COVID. You know, even a mild infection can pretend having long-term complications of the disease, which nobody really wants. And whether it's 5% or 20% of cases that develop long COVID, the nonchalance about that is worrying, because, you know, this is not just a mass infection event, it's a mass disabling event as well.
Given that we were just talking about monkeypox and that transmission has been global, very, very different kind of disease, but I do want to ask you whether or not sort of loosening travel restrictions around testing is likely to have an effect at all on community spread for COVID.
So, you know, as I said, you know, we're basically a boiling pot of COVID-19 in the United States. You know, worrying about whether, you know, one or two cases, you know, comes off a flight from Europe, et cetera, is probably less important than getting our act together domestically. You know, domestic transmission within the United States is by far the greater risk to us. And again, you know, whether you think it's deaths or hospitalizations, cases, disruption and dysfunction that we're sort of injecting into our everyday lives at work and at home, you know, the real risk is domestic transmission and letting it spread. Remember coming, you know, it's the summer, we're all outside, you know, things are much easier to sort of manage in terms of social interactions over the next few months. But once winter comes and we have another wave, we're in deep trouble. Remember, the money is out in terms of getting people vaccinated, tested, and treated for the uninsured. We have no real resources to fight COVID anymore because the Congress has not voted to extend relief to the American people. So we're going into the fall with unilateral disarmament and the chance for a wave of COVID that could really surprise us in the worst of all possible ways. Mm.
That was a little bit terrifying there, Greg. Let me ask this, if it's not about like keeping a few folks from Europe sort of out of the U.S. or something, what are some of the proactive actions that we could be taking now in anticipation of that fall and winter concern that you just articulated?
On a societal level, you know, we need the Congress to act and act quickly so that we have all the resources we need to fight the pandemic going into the fall, into the winter. They basically dragged their feet and refused to put money on the table, leaving us all terribly vulnerable as we move forward. You know, there's things we can do in our own personal lives, like, you know, I wear a mask when I go into the grocery store, or I'm going on Metro North to go down to New York City, for instance, from New Haven. There are little things you can do in your life to make it less likely that you're going to end up catching COVID or giving it to someone else. And that's, you know, indoor gatherings, you know, we have rapid tests. Use them before you go to see if you're infectious, to ask other people to do it as well. These are not, you know, huge intrusions into liberty, to wear a mask in public places indoors and to, you know, minimize indoor contact in large groups, particularly when you don't know if they're vaccinated or not, and using rapid tests if you can get access to them, which you can through the U.S. Postal Service and the federal government, to manage your risk to others as well.
Greg Gonsalves, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Yale University School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.